is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
In early November 2009, at Ryan Woods UFO Crash Conference in Las Vegas, a former police detective shared a tape-recorded interview he did on June 27, 1997, with a 72-year-old woman who had worked as a secretary for the War Department at Wright Field, Ohio, from 1942 until 1952. Wright Field became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Before marriages, her name then was June Crane, and during her work at Wright Field, she held a secret Q clearance under Atomic Energy Commission authority, heard about UFO crashes in New Mexico and retrievals of non-human bodies, and even held in her own hands a piece of what she called spaceship metal that she could not cut, and no matter how hard she twisted, the metal would always spring back to its original shape. The police detective who interviewed June Crane before her death is James E. Clarkson, 58 years old, who retired from the Aberdeen, Washington Police Department in 2000 because of a knee injury. Now Jim Clarkson investigates for a Washington state agency in the field of administrative law and is chief investigator for Washington State MUFON. Jim became interested in the UFO phenomena after reading John Fuller's book, Incident at Exeter, concerning 1965 UFO encounters in New Hampshire. Then, after he heard about the November 1986 Japanese airline pilot's report of large unidentified flying objects over Alaska and radar confirmation by Anchorage Air Traffic Control, Jim Clarkson began to read and study more about the mystery. That led to his preparing programs about the UFO phenomena for public libraries, including one in 1993 when he first met June Crane, then June Caba, after a second marriage.
I gave a program in the Ocean Shores Library in 1993, and there were probably 40-some-odd people there. And when I was all done, this very determined older woman approached me and just looked me right in the eye and said, "You're right. The government knows all about UFOs, and they're not telling the truth. They're keeping it all secret." And I said, "Well, how do you know this?" And she said, "I can't tell you." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" And she said, "Because I worked there." And I said, "Well, why can't you tell me?" And she said, "Because they'll come and arrest me." And at the time, I think part of her reservation in talking to me was that I was the detective sergeant for the Aberdeen Police Department at the time. That's a town about 25 miles away from Ocean Shores. And I think June was a little bit worried that maybe I would arrest her.
And how did you get past that psychological obstacle?
Well, I didn't for 4 years. I gave her a business card, and I thanked her, and I told her I would be really interested in talking to her in the future. And it wasn't until 1997 that I got a surprise phone call from her. And that occurred because of the 50th anniversary of Roswell, and at the same time that the public was becoming really interested in Roswell, and it was all over the news, that's when we got a heavy dose of, well, it was really all weather balloons and dummies. That was all over CNN. And one day out of the blue, my telephone rang, and I answered it, and there was June on the other end of the phone, and basically without even really saying hello, she said, "It's a damn lie." And she said, "Have you been watching CNN?" And I said that I had. And she said, "That's the same lie that they used before." She said they lied about balloons a long time ago, and they're still lying. Then she said something to me that I've never forgotten. She said, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands, and I've survived cancer twice. What are they going to do, shoot me or put me in prison? I can do either one, and I'm not that slow." So I said, "Well, how soon can I be at your house?" So I ended up packing up a yellow pad and eventually a tape recorder, not right at first, but I started going to visit her at her home in Ocean Shores, and basically we sat up late at night and had coffee, and she told me her life story. And one time I asked her if I could tape record her, and that, of course, led to a very lengthy interview. The primary interview that I did with June Crane was at her home in Ocean Shores, Washington, and it was on June 27th, 1997, and it occurred at about 10:30 in the evening.
She would have been what age?
72.
And she lived until what year and age?
Well, she died in August of 1998, so she made it just past 73. I'm not sure how much June really knew about the state of her cancer, but she had a document drawn up where she said that she was giving me the rights to her life story. And she never told me that she was going to do that. She just dropped it on me.
Right.
And so I believe that she knew. And that, of course, adds credibility because it's considered universal in any court of law that if a person thinks that they're going to pass away, I mean, obviously, if they're going to die immediately, it's called a dying declaration. But just the idea that someone knows that they're wrapping up their life, that adds a lot of credibility.
And what would be the most important information directly related to Roswell, Wright-Patterson, bodies, UFOs, that you heard that night?
Well, she told me that by the time she left Wright-Patterson for the last time in 1952, she said that they were investigating at least three crashes of alien vehicles and that there was possibly a fourth. And she did not give me exact locations other than to say that Roswell was one of those. And then there was also an incident where she stated that she had coffee with a man who said that he had just flown from New Mexico and brought in bodies.
Now that is one of the audio excerpts that we have, and I'm going to play it right here.
This sergeant, his first name's Clarence, Master Sergeant. I still can't remember that man's last name.
Okay.
But he was in charge of that airplane, and when he came there...
What kind of an airplane?
Well, it was a river transport.
Transport, a military transport.
Yeah.
And what was it that he said?
Came in from New Mexico. He said, what I brought in this morning, and he said that he brought two little men in. And he called them little green men. Then he described them as a greenish blue, and they were 4 foot tall, and they were dead.
We're talking about non-humans.
Non-humans, right.
Did he say anything else about them?
No, not really.
Were there, like, maybe other ladies there, and he's sort of, like, showing off or telling... No, he wasn't showing off.
No. These guys don't show off.
This is a serious man.
When I'm saying engineers are sort of wacky, there's one thing they're not. It's not a wackiness like you'd think of just being acting like a fool. It's just... it's hard to explain. But they're very serious. They don't tell lies. They don't have jokes. They don't do anything like that. And so when they say something, you don't lie.
Was this Master Sergeant breaking security by talking about this?
No, because we were all secure. See, when you have security like that, you can't even take your husband to a party. If we had our Christmas party, we went and there was a guard at the door. And nobody but the people in the branch are the only ones. You can bring your husband and your wife. And when you're at home, you can't talk about your job because you got that in your head. You got security and you're cleared and you keep your damn mouth shut. That's all there is to it. And it's a big burden because there's times that you'd like to talk about your job, but you can't.
Can you elaborate beyond what is on this audio excerpt?
Yes, because we also discussed this when we did not have the recording on. And she clarified that Master Sergeant Clarence, he started describing what happened, and initially everyone at the table was horrified, thinking that there had been a crash of a military aircraft, and everyone was sad and upset, thinking that perhaps somebody they knew had died in this crash. And then he clarified that, no, the people who were killed were not human, and that this wasn't a crash of an airplane.
And that's where she heard him describe the little green men who were greenish-blue?
Yes. There was something that happened later on that day that kind of adds weight to this entire conversation. That was the fact that June recalled that there was what she referred to as a too-hot memo that came out later that day. And this meant that there was a courier from the commanding officer who went to every single person who worked there, and you were required to stop what you were doing, read the memorandum, and sign off on it stating that you understood it and that you would comply. And it was telling everyone that some irresponsible person has been discussing little green men and crash saucers, and that you will cease and desist immediately upon penalty of being discharged and possibly being prosecuted. And the two things that bothered June about this, one was, if there was no truth to what this master sergeant had told everyone, then why would they even bother with this elaborate procedure? And secondly, she wanted to know how the commanding officer knew about this so quickly, because she said it wasn't that long after she had the conversation with this master sergeant.
It suggests that the coffee room where they were talking was probably bugged, and it also implies that even within Wright Field and people with Q clearances, they would threaten anybody, since they all had clearances together, they would threaten anybody who even talked to each other about non-humans.
Exactly. So in other words, they did not view this as simple office gossip.
And the very fact that they would try to strong-arm their own insiders who had similar Q clearances, including the Master Sergeant and June and the others, and do it in such a way that they were saying there was no truth to this when they all knew that it was, shows that there was kind of this 1984 newspeak going on within Wright Field among the very people who had to have access to this information to do their work.
Absolutely. It reflects a consistent policy of denial, of suppressing discussion or inquiry, and that is also furthered by the other major revelation. She talked about the scientists and engineers who came back from New Mexico, where they had experimented with the V-2 rocket and later with the Aerobee rocket. They saw UFOs routinely while they were doing their work.
This was a cover-up. When this report in newspapers said, how could such a conspiracy exist, that's how it existed. Because it was right at the very start of it. Project Blue Book was not formed to investigate those things. It was formed to stop the people from thinking that's what it was.
And somebody else was actually investigating.
Right. They were being investigated by the Project Blue Book officers, yes. That's what Project Blue Book was all about. It was to try to squelch all talk of UFOs.
And if I remember right, you mentioned that people in this group went to White Sands to do testing and then came back?
Yes.
And did they say that anything unusual had happened to
them? Well, they said they were just as thick as fleas up there. They'd sit at night, they'd sit on the outside of their motels where they were staying or the buildings, and they would just watch them go over all types and shapes. There'd be motherships, big ones with little ones coming out of it, and then they'd see them return, and they had different colored lights. Some had orange, sometimes red, yellow, different lights they would see. And then what they would do, if they would go, if the people, the engineers and scientists would report it that they saw them, they locked them up in a motel for 24 hours with no access to no radios, no people, no nothing, and they'd bring the meals into them, but have no contact with anybody, and they had them to write up what they saw, and then when they come out the following day, 24 hours later, they'd have them write it up again. And like the engineer said, to hell with it, I'm not going to report anymore. I'm not going to be locked up for 24 hours.
This accomplished two purposes. One of them was, obviously, they got at least two different accountings of whatever it was that was observed. And then they basically discouraged these scientists and engineers from discussing it further or reporting anything else in the future.
She talked with you about a subject that many of us have heard bits and fragments about, and that is metal that was found in the Roswell debris field.
Well, this is perhaps the most fascinating story, because here we're going from being an indirect witness to being a direct witness, because she said that she actually got to handle the metal.
Someone actually showed you a piece of something.
Yeah.
Was this during the same period of time?
Yes, 51, 52.
Okay, now, who showed it to you?
Okay, it was Lieutenant Rose is the one that showed it to me, or Captain Wheeler. Now, it could have been one or the other of those guys, because they were both in personnel. He walked in, and he threw it on my desk. It was a piece, about this big. And it was
about half of about size of a business card.
Yeah, about that size, and it was bent like this. And he says, "June, you're a good wrecker. Tear that thing apart, break that up." And I took it and I bent it and I twisted it, laid it back down, and it went, got right back the same shape. I got on my desk. He says, cut it, try cutting it." I got on my desk. I got my scissors out, and I snipped at it, and you know, there was no way I could cut that piece of metal. And it was as light as a feather. I had it in my hand. I would say that it didn't weigh as much as these two cards. It wasn't that heavy. It was so light, but strong, and it was about, the thickness would be about that thick. And so strong, it was sort of a grayish gunmetal type of color. And you could see that on the inside there was a different, that there was a coating on the outside, both sides of it was the same, and the inside seemed to have a sort of a light lead-colored center.
What were the edges of this like? Were they even, or was it like part of something else?
It was even. Even.
It was even.
All even. And I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's a piece of a spaceship." I said, "Well, what is it?" And he says, "Piece of a spaceship." I said, "I just come back from New Mexico, and I promised him." He had no business having it in the first place, but he...
So he was breaking security.
Yes, he was. Definitely.
Obviously, in 40 years, and even in my lifetime, being 45, I've seen improvements and changes in materials and plastic and metal and... Have you ever... Is it like anything you've seen since?
I always look at things, metal things, and I still have that curiosity because it still bothers me. And I have yet to see anything that would have those properties and look like that. And so light.
And in context, the situation was, I believe, that she was a young woman working in an office. And as has happened before in the history of the world, I think that a male was trying to impress a female, and he said too much and did too much, which is that he walked up to June kind of... flirting and flippant, and pulled a piece of this metal out of his pocket and then asked her to tear it up, asked her to try and destroy it or have some effect on it. And no matter what she did, she couldn't dent it, she couldn't tear it, she couldn't cut it or anything else, and yet, as she described very well, that when you folded it up, it would return to its original shape and it didn't look like anything had happened to it. And when she asked the officer, "What is it?" his response was, "It's a piece of a spaceship." Now, she told me later on, this was not on the recording, that what happened was that somebody else walked in the room, and as soon as somebody else walked in the room, he jammed the metal into his pocket, and that was the last time she ever saw it.
This metal, I understood that it was about the size of a standard business card, but I did not understand how thick it was.
It's not very thick. I think like maybe a couple, three, four business cards stuck together. I remember her holding her fingers like that. But every time she would say anything like that, she emphasized, "But it was as light as a feather. It weighed nothing."
Right, and so maybe the size of a business card and an eighth of an inch thick.
That might be right.
Nothing about analysis?
No, because she didn't ever see that. she probably wasn't supposed to see this at all, and he probably wasn't supposed to have it, and if he was supposed to have it, he wasn't supposed to be using it to impress the office staff. Her paperwork, her documents showed that she was steadily promoted, and I believe that she was used as kind of a general purpose office manager slash tech secretary clerk. She told me about logging top secret material in and out of safes. That was part of her duties routinely. She also told me along the way she was required to type up standard response letters to people who reported UFOs. Now, she didn't say directly that she worked for Project Blue Book. My understanding was that she was tasked to write some of these letters, and that the context was that these were just dismissive letters, you know, that the particular type of air vehicle that you have described is not possible given standard aerodynamic principles, etc. It was sort of just to get rid of the person type letter, and that she had helped write those letters.
And that reinforced her perspective of Project Blue Book as being really a misinformation project as far as the public was concerned, while behind the scenes, real scientists, real engineers, and real military people were doing serious investigations that never reached the public.
Exactly. That's the number one bottom line for what I learned from June Crane, that what the public is told and what these scientists and engineers discuss behind closed and very secure doors were two entirely different things.
And that she even had to take the typewriter ribbon out of her typewriter and put it in a safe every night?
Absolutely. In fact, she told me one time she got in trouble because she left one piece of paper in a drawer in her desk. She told me that they took security. They were extremely serious about it. And in fact, she described on one occasion that there was another person she worked with that she was suspicious of, and she described in detail how that person eventually got picked up by the FBI, and she never saw that woman again, and they actually took her desk away.
What is your perspective on why the overwhelming policy of denial in the interest of national security in its requirement for everyone involved to lie?
I think it starts back with one word. Fear. And I think they were afraid of what they had found and what the implications might be, because bearing in mind that their fundamental job is to maintain the security of the skies over the United States and the interests of the United States anywhere in the world, and suddenly now we are confronted with something that is completely out of our control, and presumably if they have the kind of technology to come here wherever they come from, any sort of weaponry that they might possess would almost certainly be overwhelming. So they're afraid of what they found. They're also afraid of how the public might react, given our religious, social, and political institutions that are dependent upon everybody thinking that everything is predictable and okay. There's fear throughout this whole subject, and I believe that that's what dictated their response. They keep dealing with it from a mentality of fear. I can't imagine that they're hostile. I mean, if they were going to be hostile, I don't know why we wouldn't already know it. The only thing I could presume is that someone knows something that's so terrible that they are just scared to death that it will ever get out.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com. to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.